Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. I know you are just starting to listen to us, but we've been going for a good 15 minutes, so...
Right.
Now you just have to catch up. Well, good morning and welcome to our roundtable panel discussion. It is a delight to have you with us. Let me introduce our panel to you. A reminder that you can join us in letter by writing to us at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. And what a panel we have for you today. Albany County District Attorney David Soares is with us. Good morning, sir.
Hello, sir.
A great pleasure to have you with us. We also are thrilled to have a community engagement editor and staff reporter for the Berkshire Eagle, Jen Smith, back with us. Good morning.
Thanks for having me back. Good morning.
A delight to have
you. Well, you're a star now. Yeah. You're that's a star now, so that's it.
Communication consultant Teresa Bourgeois joins us. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
You're already on fire.
I'm fired up. I'm ready to go.
You're ready. Speaking of fired up, Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir.
And Debbie Downer in the corner.
And we welcome you again, panel@wamc.org. Just a reminder, keep your letters short, keep them to the point, and by the way, pre-read them so we know what the hell you're trying to say. Okay.
Right.
Now, let's go on to what is happening. Of course, the top story is the terrorism, the act of terrorism in Manhattan. We have learned that this is the deadliest terrorist attack in the city since 9/11. 8 killed, 11 injured, perhaps more. A driver plowed a pickup truck down a crowded bike path along the Hudson River in Manhattan on Tuesday before being shot by a police officer in what officials are calling the deadliest terror attack since 9/11. The rampage ended when the motorist, whom the police have identified, smashed into a school bus, jumped out of his truck, and ran up and down the highway waving a pellet gun and a paintball gun and shouting Allah Akbar, Arabic for God is great. Before he was shot in the abdomen by the officer, he remained in critical condition on Tuesday evening. Mayor Bill de Blasio declared the rampage a terrorist attack. Federal law enforcement authorities were leading the investigation. Investigators discovered handwritten notes in Arabic near the truck that indicated allegiance to the Islamic State. That is what the basics of the story. And, of course, there is much more to come out over the next hours and days as to what the motivation was and how long this had been in the works and how it happened.
David, is it your impression that the greatest sentence that can be done with this guy, or am I all wrong about this, is life in prison? Or there's no death penalty for this, is there?
Well, this is definitely going to be a federal prosecution.
Oh, therefore it would be, yeah.
Yeah, it's a federal prosecution, and what you can anticipate, especially with this administration, is the pursuit of the death penalty for any acts of terrorism, I believe. But it also is it's going to be a reminder for us, especially those of us in this community, to once again start thinking about target hardening. One of the things that I picked up on in this story was the fact that there were very few entrances to this location,
yeah,
you know, along the western side of the highway.
I know, and
so we're going to have to start rethinking and reshaping our communities and engaging in a lot of target hardening, because I think we were here.
What's the term you're using? Target.
For example,
hardening.
Yeah, okay.
For example, you have one area where a vehicle can actually fit onto.
Yeah.
They have an access point. We've got to consider blocking those areas and making those areas available only to service vehicles. I think we saw something like this very similar at Times Square. And I think right now the effort on the part of the investigators is to arrive at a determination quickly as to whether or not this was a directed attack or an inspired attack.
Yeah. You know, it's funny what happens to all of us when we hear reports of this kind. You know, I've been on that path. I've been on the one up, you know, the Upper West Side a lot. And I kind of keep thinking, I mean, I know this is irrational and sort of silly, but I keep thinking, you're on that path, you're next to the river, and you see a car coming at you that way, do you jump in the river?
It's a human reaction. I think the schools,
I think you go wherever you can go to get out of the way.
Schools were getting out at that time.
But you almost never hear of that.
If you hear the reports, there is a lot of college students in the area and high school students, and obviously there was a bus in the area, so people just ran wherever they could.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing whether you have a fire in a place or other attacks. You know, people 9/11, people jumped out of buildings because they were afraid of what was happening.
And I may have missed the opportunity here to talk about this, but, you know, part of the lesson for all of us.
You got
know,
an hour and 20 minutes. You have plenty of opportunity.
Well, as Americans, it's having to learn new terms that otherwise we wouldn't ever have to learn.
Like target hardening.
Soft targets, hard targets. We have, you know, incredible amounts of soft targets in our communities. And one of the challenges for us living in this world now is being able to identify those soft targets and trying to engage in processes that harden those targets
Do you do that, David?
We consult on these issues. For example, crime prevention through environmental design. You know, the more lighting you have, you know, the less attractive you are and the less attractive that particular space is going to be. And I think that if you walk through Times Square, you can see where law enforcement and they've engaged in a lot of, you know, hardening of these targets. But I also think we need to engage in more of that.
But, you know, and you're absolutely correct, of course, the understanding that I had in listening to some security experts talk on television last night was that part of the problem in this particular case, the one access point to that bike path was where police and emergency vehicles could go, one, to dodge the traffic that would be up for 40 blocks in the case of an emergency such as a 9/11 type event, but also so you have to have accessibility for them, but then not for such vehicles that are going down.
Exactly.
And also then the placement of either officers or something at those points to keep vehicles that shouldn't be going. But in some cases it's to increase security that is also adding to the issue.
I do notice that in the Upper West Side, for example, where I'm a lot, there are in front of the Jewish community centers and things like that, there are all kinds of barriers, cement pods and barriers and things of that kind, which I suppose it becomes very important because you're trying to figure out who the targets are going to be.
Well, the best city in the world to actually see target hardening and seeing it in a way that sort of blends in with everything else is Washington, D.C.
Yeah, sure.
There are entire access roads that are blocked off, and they're blocked off not with necessarily a lot of cement and concrete walls, but they put some statues there. They put other devices that harden those
flower
targets.
Flower boxes that are actually concrete underneath.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But having just been there 2 weeks ago, but if somebody wants to gain a speed to then go up onto the mall, there's really nothing stopping people from doing that.
The only thing that you can hope for in those moments is to slow it down and to allow for, you know, first responders to react. I mean, I don't think in the process of target hardening, anyone is operating under the illusion that this is going to stop everything.
All right. So the president blamed this all on Chuck Schumer today, saying that the terrorist came into our country through what is called the Diversity Visa Lottery Program, a Chuck Schumer beauty. I want merit-based. He essentially blamed the terrorist attack and what he characterized as soft immigration policies promoted by Democrats, singling out Chuck Schumer, the state senior lawmaker, and the party's leader in the upper chamber. He made clear that he was getting his information from Fox News, as he often does in the morning. We are fighting hard for merit-based immigrations. No more Democrat lottery systems. We must get much tougher and smarter.
By the way, Uzbekistan, right, is not on his list of forbidden countries to come from.
Right.
Of course, he doesn't mention that.
Yeah. Well, his first tweet, we must not allow ISIS to return or enter our country after defeating them in the Middle East and elsewhere enough. I mean, I think somebody needed to explain to him where Uzbekistan was.
I
just don't think that we can't wall ourselves off to this problem. We do have to take precautions. And I think let's step back and say thoughts and prayers are with everyone who was killed, their family. I mean, the families of those killed and injured, and many of them, four or five Argentinians. And a Danish person.
Belgian.
But just like the wall in Mexico is not going to solve the problems of drugs and people coming into this country, we just can't wall ourselves off. We have to give credit to those in law enforcement in New York and in the intelligence community who have prevented this for all these many years. I mean, this is the first since 9/11.
But you know what, Teresa? I think that there is a possibility here that what we were seeing yesterday is the real fear that I have about all of this. This guy, I think, wanted to be killed. And the reason I say that is he got out of that car with two phony guns.
Sure. Right.
And I think he was looking for death by cop.
Right. But I mean, we have to just...
What are we doing
around the world? I mean, just listen to a report this morning about the Saudis bombing a marketplace in a hotel in Yemen, killing many civilians. You can't control chaos,
and you can't control someone who... I mean, this particular suspect has been in the country since 2010, so who knows what has gone through his mind for the past 7 years. And the same thing with Stephen Paddock. We still don't know why he did what he did in Las Vegas. But
a very different reaction from the president in the White House to, 500 people being shot in Las Vegas,
absolutely.
58 people being killed. And the response was, now's not the time to discuss it. And within, before all the information was in, this time now was the time. But I think we have to understand what is causing the disdain. I mean, you have a person running for U.S. Senate that the senators are endorsing, who says that a duly elected person from Minnesota, a congressman who was elected, shouldn't be given a seat just because he's a Muslim. I mean, we just have to...
Let me take the con on this business. I mean, I think that ISIS is a very bad organization. And I think their attempt to do a caliphate and everything else would not have changed if Trump were not elected president. In other words, I think there's a fair assumption here that you can make that. You know, that's a sort of a liberal position that we have to stop doing chaos around the world, which is also true. But I don't know that ISIS, which is not a good group of people, would have been reacting any more favorably or any less draconian than they are right now.
But read Tom Friedman today about what's going on in Niger, and he has a great piece about how climate change is changing the economy there and creating incredible poverty, and that we are backing away from any economic help there, and it becomes a breeding ground. So yes, ISIS is there, but we have to figure out a range of ways, and not just building walls. We have to harden the targets as much as possible. We have to do as much intelligence as possible, but we also have to try to
three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
David, you were going to say something?
I just have a real difficult time with our culture and the way that our culture decides to react to extreme acts of violence. Mm. For example, in New York City, just several months ago, there was a person who mowed down a number of people with a vehicle in Times Square. And we didn't call that a terrorist act. There was another villain who just killed over 50 people and maimed hundreds of other people. And we didn't call that a terrorist act. But here we have a person from Uzbekistan who takes his vehicle. He yells a few things. The FBI and all of the intelligence agencies are still trying to determine whether this person was inspired or directed. Those are very significant Those are qualifications and categories that are very significant. If it's directed, we have a much bigger problem. We have to do a much more thorough investigation to find out what part of a, if this person was part of a cell, if this person was directed, and where was that direction coming from. If this person was inspired, well, then he's just on the wrong websites. And boy, that to me is a much scarier proposition, right? Because that
could
just
be anybody.
Happen.
Could be anyone, anywhere. Can't wall it off.
Right? But I think our reaction to these issues, our reaction to these issues should be the same. And it shouldn't depend on the identity, the gender, or the ethnic background of these violent people for us to react a certain way.
Again, I think that's a really important point. And also because ISIS isn't claiming backing of this particular event, too, which normally they tend to pop up and say things. But there is this automatic link because of perhaps the language that was allegedly used in Arabic, perhaps the phrase that was said. But I think that there is a danger of, and even in the media, of reporting things that have not been verified. There's still speculation. And again, personally, I think it's also disturbing that how quickly something is labeled terrorism or isn't labeled terrorism.
That's right. This business about it. Was this a terrorist act or wasn't it?
Well, they said there was a note.
No, so yeah. What?
But the guy
jumps out of the car and he says Ali Akbar or whatever, and you know, and he brandishes the thing. I mean, what is this big discussion as to whether that's terrorism or not?
In fairness to the first responders in the law enforcement community, what we often try to do is to contextualize your fear, so that we're trying to put out as much information as you can that's not going to harm the investigation, but we're trying to provide you with some context so that you know how to properly react. In other words, if there's two or three bodies found in a home, you want to make sure that if you have enough information to determine that there's not a mad gunman out in the community, you inform the public of that fact.
I'm going to pause you there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, David Soares, and we also have Teresa Bourgeois and Jen Smith with us. We welcome all of you and your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I just want to quickly go back for a moment in the series of tweets this morning that the president did, turning his focus from comforting those impacted to blaming ultimately Chuck Schumer for the diversity visa lottery program. Just a little bit on this, the diversity visa has been a point of contention for years. Republican Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue have introduced a bill endorsed by Trump that would eliminate the diversity lottery and certain categories of family-based green cards, and then would transform the remaining employment-based visas into a point system that favors heavily, highly skilled, highly educated English-speaking immigrants. But while there is consensus around needing to reform the process, limited support exists even within the GOP for Cotton and Perdue's bill. Senator Flake, an Arizona Republican who has been an ardent critic of Trump, noted in a tweet Wednesday that the Gang of Eight bill that Chuck Schumer was a part of and took a lead part, and that passed the Senate on a wide bipartisan basis and included removing the diversity lottery program, had it been signed into law, would not have done away with the diversity visa program. So Jeff Flake ultimately coming to the defense of Chuck Schumer and trying to get the politics of this particular issue right. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we have several in front of us.
Well, first of all, Tony, our good friend Tony, writes from New York, the running path on the lower west side is not adjacent to the river like the one on the upper west side. There's a park in between. Tony is right. As I was saying those words, I was thinking, somebody's going to call me on this. However, on the upper west side, the path is next to the river, and so I'm not all that wrong. And Jeannie says, when I still worked at the New York State Department of Transportation, the reconstruction of the West Side Highway was one of the projects I worked on. DOT built the pedestrian trail as part of that project, and we added street trees, bollards, and other things to deter an errant vehicle from accidentally crossing from the highway into the path of the pedestrians. That was before 9/11, and those barriers would be hard more if we were building today. And that's from Jeannie in Albany.
Great letter, Jeannie. Thanks for that.
Okay. And then Eve says, is there a difference between a young man who lives and trains in a foreign country for the purpose of attacking Westerners and, capital letters, a lonely, depressed young man who seizes on a common theme, jihad, in commission of an angry, desperate act? I think the solution to these two problems are very different, Eve in Rexford. And then Reed says, comment, 8 people were killed in the worst terror attack in New York City since 9/11. How many have died from the terror of gun violence in New York City over the same period? One is a major news for days, as it should be. The other goes nearly unnoticed, and that's from Reed in Northampton. District Attorney Soares, you have anything on that one?
You know, the only thing I can say is this idea that I'll give you a local example. Where there was a philosophical approach to fighting crime in this community at one time, where there was a philosophy of protecting Center Square at all costs while allowing for the neighborhoods that surround that area to go as they would go. The only thing that you end up creating is a goldfish effect, where the people that live inside the protected area have to be very cautious about all of those people knocking on the glass that are outside of those areas. Mm-hmm. And you're actually putting those people in those protected areas at greater risk. And the only reason I mention this is because this philosophy about building walls in the United States and keeping people through, you know, ineffective immigration policies that have never proven to work nowhere in the world is going to create the same effect here. You're going to have temporary, you know, what feels like a very good and safe environment, but the reality is it isn't, because the conditions that continue to give rise to people joining Al-Qaeda, joining ISIS, will continue to exist, if not worsen.
And Jed Smith of the Berkshire Eagle, I wanted to ask you, because you live in a city that has its problems with guns right now. How do you relate to what David just said about protecting some neighborhoods perhaps more than others?
I think, it's about balance and finding pathways for inclusion, those long-term solutions of making better neighborhoods. If you look in the city of Pittsfield, for example, there's still huge disparities. I can go, one direction and see these great estates, and I can go another direction and see perpetually run-down housing with, as we were talking before, street lighting that's not been fixed for quite some time, cracks in the sidewalk, things like that. And I think you have to look at all the ways different social issues interconnect and lead to some of these incidents of violence. I mean, and in particular in Pittsfield right now, I've used this phrase a few times now about bystander culture and not speaking up, not reporting, and also people not doing inreach and asking questions. Well, why isn't this happening? Why isn't change being made? Why isn't this being reported? And I think there's a lot of social disparities that can contribute
to that. We all prosper if we're all experiencing safety and prosperity. We all prosper. It is an illusion to believe that you can protect communities, that you can keep people safe, when people are experiencing certain inequities. And it leads you right into the conversation about this tax plan, right? I mean, I hate to go from the streets to, you know, corporate tax breaks, but if people aren't all benefiting, if we're not all benefiting, if you're not creating opportunities to experience prosperity, then we are going to suffer, all of us.
That's a great point.
It's absolutely interconnected.
Back to the letters. Good morning, panel. Good morning, Mr. Soares. Alan hit the point. Uh-huh. In many of these cases with Islamic terrorism, the perpetrator is hoping to be killed. That's the most glorious end they can achieve. I would think law enforcement would be wise in these cases to shoot to wound and keep these people alive. Number one, for information. Number two, to thwart the ultimate mission, which is to be a martyr. What's your opinion on that? And that's from Rick in Sawgrass.
Law enforcement are not trained to wound. Excuse me. Law enforcement, they are trained to eliminate the threat. And, you know, I know that on television you'll have, instances where you can shoot someone in the leg. But the largest portion of a human being's body happens to be right below the neck and above the waist. And that's where law enforcement, they're trained to shoot.
And if you see some guy standing with what looks like two guns, that makes it even more imperative to put a stop to that.
Absolutely.
Okay, and thank you for that, Rick. And then Doug says, let's take a deep breath and remember that you're more likely to be killed by lightning than by terrorism. Be vigilant and go about your life. You know, Doug, I think you're right, of course, but it doesn't give you solace that you know there are, you know, eight people dead, six of whom, by the way, are people who come from outside the United States who are here as tourists. And if you're one of them, or if you're in their families, it doesn't help you to think that you have a better chance of being hit by lightning than by being killed. I mean, it's terrible. You're looking perplexed, Teresa.
I'm hoping that this man doesn't write Hallmark cards in the future.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I do think that we have to keep it in context. I think that this is the first since 9/11, and we have to applaud law enforcement and the intelligence community for that tremendous work. But in fact, there'll be a lot of activity around this, and you know, what laws are we going to change? What rules are we going to change? But I go back to Las Vegas, 500 plus people shot. 58 people dead. The repercussions for that are just astounding. Yet, no call for action.
It's exactly a month.
A month, and they can't even pass bump stock legislation. Nothing. Silence.
And this last note from Margie: one, the president doesn't bark about how the Las Vegas shooter entered the U.S. Two, how can the prospect of death sentence help in the case of terrorism perpetrated by suicide bombers? Three, let's keep our eye on the ball and not stop talking about the special counsel's important work. Thank you, panel. Well, yeah, you know, I was thinking about this because the day before this happened, obviously Trump was on the hot seat. And then yesterday on the news, almost nothing.
No, I think what this incident has done is it's helped you know, the editors over at Fox News to actually have something to put on in terms of programming. Besides talking about President Clinton. Yeah, and her administration.
And her administration, right. Yeah. But I think David's point about the tax bill and the budget is so critical because, you know, what are we investing in as a country? What are our priorities? And are we going to expand the economic divide? You know, there's just an incredible economic divide in this country, unlike it's been in a long time. And are we going to have tax policies that increase that economic divide or help to close that economic divide? Trump's rhetoric and the Republican rhetoric is that this is going to be for taxpayers, but everything on paper says it's not. And if you have these deep tax cuts, inevitably you're going to have deeper program cuts to follow. And then how will the police be able to do their jobs? How will you be able to, even if you want to harden targets, how are you going to afford that? How are you going to afford the infrastructure changes? And I don't think those are the solutions. I worked with Mayor Flynn in Boston on urban violence.
Well, there are solutions, Teresa. For example, we had a letter from Ryan who said, ban assault trucks now. In other words, no one needs a truck that large with that much horsepower. I am tired of seeing people die on the roads and by cars. Stop the car, C-A-R, capital, carnage.
We have someone who's proposing bringing back the oxen.
Yeah, I don't. If you've ever tried to move from one apartment to the other, you need
a truck.
As I'm doing right now, because it's not all fitting in my hatchback.
You need a pickup truck.
I think that was meant to be satirical.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope it was.
I'm sure it's satirical.
You know what I find so troubling is
I never know anymore.
There are consequences to the to elections, and you know, granted, you have a Republican House, a Republican Senate, and a Republican President. So, if they were to carve up a tax plan that reflected the values of the ideology, that I can accept that. What I cannot accept, just like with health care, is the effort to just rewrite, you know, something as complex as the tax code just so that you can reflect a win before the end of December.
The problem is that the rhetoric that they campaigned on, that they got elected on, is different than the legislation that they're putting forward. That's why the health care bill didn't work for them, because what they claimed it would do and when the put pen to paper and what it was actually going to do were different, just like this tax bill. Why isn't there supposed to be a tax bill today?
$3 trillion in deficit.
They have a, you know, there's a big, huge hole
and
that they can't fill.
What's further troubling with both of these issues is that they're being done in silos and they're not exploring the greater repercussions for the general public. So if you can't save for retirement under the new tax cuts and your premiums have skyrocketed under the new the health legislation, you're screwed.
has anyone noticed that that we no longer have hearings on any of these issues?
Yeah.
That we
regular
now,
orders.
We have our legislative body acting like the judiciary, and we have the judiciary acting like our legislative bodies. So you could pass terrible immigration policies, and the courts will say, "Nope, not good."
They're fixing it.
We have more witnesses appearing before our House and our Senate subcommittees for testimony. It's just a little absurd.
And I think these short-term decisions are going to have long-term effects after this administration. And so I think there's going to be a lot of cleanup with all the people that are going to be affected.
Well, we have three branches of government, David, and you know it is better than I do. And, you know, if that breaks down, if the ability to watch each other of those branches breaks down, we're in real trouble. Because, as in a slide towards, you know, autocracy or something much worse, fascism, or, you know, then I think that's what's happening now, except that I think what's turning out to be important is the idea that the Senate is getting ready to turn on Trump.
Here's what keeps me up at night. What keeps me up at night is we now live in a country where we put partisanship above patriotism. If you would have told me 10 years ago that the day will come where the country, the nation that we engage in the Cold War for so many years would somehow collude with a campaign, right, to prevent, you know, the free process of elections in our country. If you'd have said that to me 10 years ago, I said, no, you're pitching me the script to a show on television or a movie. But this is a reality. And the other day, what was so significant that I think a vast majority of our colleagues in the media missed is the fact that there was a guilty plea by an individual involved in the campaign who acknowledged lying about having information or being contacted and engaging in collusion with the Russians. I can't believe we're here.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about all of these issues and much more. We welcome your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Let's go over a few letters, and then we'll move on to other topics.
Okay, Joe, thanks for the opportunity. Megan says, Manhattan. Good morning, panel. I've noticed lately after recent horrific events like the one in Manhattan and Las Vegas, news have been frequently using terms like the deadliest shooting since or the deadliest mass killing since. I do not like this way of reporting these hateful acts. It's almost like they are giving the next person a number to beat, comparing one tragedy to another with flashy titles. Maybe it's just me, but it seems like an inappropriate way of reporting these events, Megan
It's a fair assessment, I think. There's a cyclical way of reporting and drawing in headlines. There's that old adage of in the newsroom that if it bleeds, it leads.
Sure.
And I think there is a kernel of truth to that. And I think that's a fair observation.
But I think you need context, though.
But that's a great letter. That's a great letter because, you know, here in this instance, we're saying, you know, terrorist acts since 9/11. But I think in every mass shooting, when you're comparing, you're literally comparing to an event that took place less than a year ago.
Right.
Less than 2 years ago. So that's a great letter, and I think it really helps to frame.
Well, I suspect the last mass shooting, there's a website that shows, but probably within the last week, you know, there's probably been a mass shooting.
I do think it does. I agree with the point of the letter. I do think it brings up something that Teresa mentioned too, though, which is that it does put it into a context that, because of the law enforcement and because of the great work that has been done, there has not been another attack in the city of New York. There have been several attempts, but that this is the worst attack since then, I think does say a lot. So I understand the meaning of the letter, but
yep.
I also think that context is important.
I think it'd be interesting to highlight in maybe a subhead that connecting point.
Agreed. Yes.
But what if we put as much attention on terrorism, domestic violence and domestic guns death as we do in international terrorism incidents?
I was just going to say that. Because I think when law enforcement, first responders, intelligence agencies focus on issues, there is a level of predictability and you can engage in prevention. However, when you allow for an industry to basically determine what our laws are going to be, and they can continue to operate without any regulation. I think the results are going to be what you've seen in Las Vegas, where a person can own, you know, over 20, you know, weapons and assault weapons, and perpetrate that kind of violence on a peaceful group of people.
James says, "Words matter, dear panel. What makes violence terrorism is not the ethnicity or nation of origin of the attacker, but the existence of a political intention. All the dictionaries agree on this point. Saipov is probably a terrorist, assuming current report holds true. Amon and Cliven Bundy, and Timothy McVeigh are terrorists. Stephen Paddock is not a terrorist. The meaning of words matter." Well, James, we disagree on that one. For whatever it's worth, I think, in fact, you know, terrorists are people who kill other people. And, you know, that's my sense of it. Anyway, Jade says, eliminate to treat. Only in the U.S. and perhaps Saudi Arabia do the police eliminate the threat by murder. The response of some on the panel tells me they have drunk the Kool-Aid. These are human lives we are talking about. How many children and innocent people have been shot by police and the police are found to have acted properly? Crying in my soup, Jade.
Anybody? I don't even know what you're trying to say here, but...
We drank the Kool-Aid, David, because we believe that, as you said before, a policeman's job is to stop the murder from happening at that moment, and they shoot them. And so there's this, you know, the rifleman, I like that program a lot. The rifleman, you know, he can shoot anybody. He can shoot their toes off as opposed to shooting to kill them. And I think that that's Jade's point. We know that that's not possible.
Thank you, Jade.
Yeah. Brian says of terrorism, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. We can make new laws and regulations, and we can harden targets. But those bent on perpetrating acts of violence will find a way. Keep in mind, the September 11th attacks were perpetrated with weapons that were legal to carry on a plane at that time. And that's from Brian.
Brian just mentioned the price of freedom, and I think that is probably a good segue to we should probably ask John Kelly what the price of freedom.
Oh, I want to get into that. Let's hold that. Let's talk about John Kelly, and we'll get to that story as soon as we come back from the break. Ray Graff with news. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, 5 minutes past 10 o'clock. Alan Chartok is here, Jen Smith, David Soares, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Right before we went to break, we were talking about the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, who appeared on the Laura Ingraham Show on Monday night. I believe it was the premiere of that program. And if by appearing on Laura Ingraham Show on Monday night, according to the New York Times, John Kelly was trying to do damage control after the indictments of Trump associates, didn't work. Okay,
not so much.
Instead,
he changed the topic, though.
Well, certainly he did. Instead, Mr. Kelly, the White House Chief of Staff, resurrected the debate over Confederate monuments, previously fueled by his boss, President Trump, over the summer, and the Confederacy itself. He called Robert E. Lee, quote, an honorable man who gave up his country to fight for his state, said that men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand, and argued that, quote, the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
Somebody should read their Constitution and remember about the three-fifths compromise. That was supposed to be the compromise. A black person was not a full person. That was the compromise. We know it wouldn't happen. We knew that in England they got rid of slavery a lot sooner than we did. There is no moral justification for telling people because of skin pigment that they have to be slaves. I mean, it's that simple.
Christina Wilkie, a reporter for CNBC, used Twitter to live blog Monday's interview on the Fox News program The Ingraham Angle. Her tweet quoting Mr. Kelly's lack of an ability to compromise statement spread quickly. Compromise on what exactly was her question. The reaction was swift and unforgiving, with many commentators ridiculing Mr. Kelly for suggesting that slavery was an issue on which a compromise could or should have been reached. So it was one thing in the debate in Charlottesville to say that there were good people on both sides. That is one thing, one disturbing thing, but it's one thing.
It wasn't a good thing.
But now to say that there were two sides on the Civil War and slavery, I don't know.
I just want to be in the huddle, right? I just want to be in the huddle. Where, you know, the senior staff, they get together, they go, okay, listen, we you're going to go on the Laura Ingraham Show, and they're going to ask you some questions about the Civil War, right? And what you're going to come back with is there could have been compromise, right? And then there were good people on both sides. I'm thinking the words on both sides should be eliminated, like, The person who's running the press operation,
right,
just don't ever say on both sides. Even when you're asked, right, like, how do you want your eggs fried, don't say on both sides. This is just amazing to me that a general, right, a retired general from the U.S. Army, okay, he's the person who was supposed to be, you know,
supposed to be
disciplining the president of the United States, when asked a question about the Civil War.
He's the sane one, right?
Right, yeah. And what he has to say is, well, you know, there could have been compromise. I want to know what that compromise would have looked like, right, when you're talking about slavery.
Do you think on Lower Manhattan last night that there could have been compromise between the guy driving the truck and the people who were using the bike path?
Oh, you know, it's amazing because it's the ignorance is staggering. And these are the people who, in addition to the tax plan, in addition to health care, you know, we have this slow march into crisis, international crisis with North Korea and Iran. And, you know, I don't understand how, if you're a Republican senator, a Republican member of the House, how you're not white-knuckled right now, you know, on your chair, trying to figure out what to do to keep this particular administration in check. It is amazing to me.
Well, a couple of things here, David. First of all, remember what this is all about. This is about the base, and this is about the continuing reminder to the white redneck base of the people who were there that black people have to be kept in their place. That's why I suspect when he walked in there. And in the huddle, who's the quarterback in the huddle? In other words, who's giving the orders? It's Trump. These are not people who listen to subordinates about what to be saying. But as we know from the Sanders woman, they're the people who are being told what to say by the big guy at the big guy at the top. And I'm sure you say you'd like to be in that huddle. On the way into that place, you had the president of the United States giving him his orders.
Leadership in the military requires that you understand, and your understanding of history has to be much greater than the average citizen. What do generals study? Wars. Mm. So when did General Kelly's studies begin? I mean, the path to confrontation, those things are things you need to know, right? In Vietnam, I'm sure General Kelly understands, you know, the issues that led to the conflict in Vietnam. I'm sure. But you're telling me that when it comes to the United States of America and its formation, you mean to tell me that General Kelly had no understanding or appreciation for history and slavery?
So either, David, he's dumb, which I doubt, or he knows what he's doing.
Well, somehow he knows how to position this thing. But then they move it to the next level, because the next day everybody, of course, in the press briefing asks Sarah Huckabee Sanders to clarify the general's remarks. She says that, quote, there was pretty strong consensus among people from the left, the right, the north, and the south that a failure to compromise contributed to the war.
She was being told what to say also.
She read that. She had it in front of her.
Yes.
Absolutely. And, Jen, you know, I think if any consolation comes out of any of this, it gives our classrooms a really thoughtful conversation to say, you know, this is what really happened. I think their voters today don't even know really enough about the history of our conflicts, of our current crises that are happening, to rebut otherwise.
So, Jen, doesn't it matter where the classroom is? I mean, if the classroom is in Manhattan, you know what the answer is.
In a blue state, I guess you've got a pretty decent chance of understanding that the Civil War was about slavery. But mm-hmm. if you're in a red state, I guess it's just, you know, powerful white leaders who just couldn't compromise.
Well, obviously, he's wrong on the history. But what keeps worrying me about in general about the U.S. right now is Trump and team are leaving to go on a critically important foreign trip, going into Asia, mm-hmm. where China is stronger than it's ever been. And it's a major economic force that we need to be really tending to, where, you know, North Korea, because of Trump and because of North Korea, has never been more tense, I don't think. And, you know, how are we as a country positioned for the next 10 days in this very important 10 days in terms of foreign policy? It's a very important 10 days in terms of domestic policy, with choices that are going to be made about the budget and tax. And, you know, just go to the word compromise. What are we going to do about compromise around the tax bill? What are we going to do about compromise around the budget bill? How are we going to deal with compromise around North Korea? I mean, he's wrong on the history, and it's atrocious. Did he do it purposefully to change the topic away from trying to move away from the Mueller thing, or does he generally believe that? I kept thinking about what Michelle Obama said about how the presidency does not change who you are, it reveals who you are.
Absolutely.
So did this reveal more about who John Kelly is?
Well, I think,
and what about compromise?
And I think that's part of the ongoing conflicts with rhetoric that we have in this country right now, whether you look at all the protests that we've had, whether it's the alt-right or others about free speeches on campus, and it takes away from what's actually happening. Like you said, there's so much happening in the next 10 days, but because the media shifts focus to talk about rhetoric, and it also creates a lot of tensions and disillusionment of being actively engaged in the issues that
this
that
isn't
matter
a president.
As well.
First, there was no compromise with this. I mean, he was completely wrong on the history. Let's just
acknowledge that. You know that Abraham Lincoln spent a lot of time not wanting to have a civil war.
Yeah.
Come on now. He did. He didn't want that war. He knew I think he had to deal with it when it got to his plate, but he didn't want it, and everybody knows it.
Right, but there was what? There was...
Ta-Nehisi Coates tweeted yesterday saying this is really basic stuff, easily accessible, not tucked away in archives somewhere. Lincoln's own platform was a compromise. Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He proposed to limit slavery's expansion, not end it. Shocking that someone charged with defending their country in some profound way does not comprehend the country they claim to defend.
But that's the problem. Even if you can say, okay, there was a huddle and they tried to distract. Well, okay, so if you manage to achieve that goal and you've distracted us, what does that do to your credibility and all the other issues?
That's exactly.
So you're heading to Japan, China, for the next 10 days.
They don't give a flying frog,
I couldn't even reach the button in time.
It's right here.
I'm so glad he said frog.
But I just want to get to something that David said of earlier that we were talking about as we began this conversation. But there's still that narrative that he's the adult in the room. Well, we have to stop that too, don't we? I mean,
yes.
isn't that ship sailed at this point?
Well, I think I have the answer here in a letter, guys. And the letter says it's to David from Steve. And in capital letters, the topic line says, General Kelly retired from the United States Marine Corps, David. Dear David, not a soldier, a Marine. Semper Fidelis, Steve.
Okay, well, that doesn't help us on this issue.
Thanks, Steve. Dude.
but how we have to get away from that, don't we? I mean, that he can be contained, that he has, that's proven not to be the case. I know when General Kelly came on board, people were saying, well, you're going to see the tweets diminish, maybe you're going to see a more disciplined White House, you're going to see a crackdown on the people who have access to the president. I don't know.
There's nothing polished or disciplined about what's going on at all.
No, I think you're wrong. I do. I think
it's much more disciplined than it was. I think it's much.
But it's still crazy.
It's still crazy, but it's much more.
But he had a strategy for winning.
I don't understand.
And he won. And he thinks that the way to win the next time is to keep the same group who are going to vote for him the next time. And that if the heavens prevail, he'll be able to bring.
No, that's
it
a different,
I don't know if that's
they're stoking
but
a racial divide. They
that's
are
a different
strategic.
Issue, though.
No, I feel it like, isn't. I don't think it is. In other words, I think by stoking the
I'm talking. Yeah. I'm just talking about Kelly specifically, about Kelly being the guy who was brought in by whoever in the administration to put the president under his thumb and to give him some
structure.
Bob Corker said an adult daycare center. So basically, Kelly was the guy in charge of that daycare center, right? Well, that doesn't seem to be working.
Well, as much as I admire Joe, I have to say I don't agree with this. I think truly, they think this is the path to electoral political success, and that they know what they're doing. And I also think Kelly is not in charge of this president, who many people think is a lunatic. But really the other way around. I think the president tells him.
But they're winning because we're talking about this today and not Papadopoulos or Mueller or the tax bill
or the fact that
health care is, you know, today the health care bill starts and we're a month out of No Child Health Plus.
Normally, I would agree with you. Every administration, okay, when there is a vulnerability, they're quick to try to jump to another subject in order to draw your attention away from the vulnerability. But what other administrations usually do is they do their best to clean up those vulnerabilities, to repair, right? In this instance, that doesn't happen. They set fire here. And then they try to distract you from the fire, and they start another fire.
It's still 40%. It's still 40%.
They're playing wedge politics. And what we learned from this is that General Kelly's in the game too. That's what we learned, because they're playing wedge politics. And what we thought was that General Kelly was on the sideline saying, please don't do that, please don't do that. Mm-hmm. What we learned is that General Kelly's in the game playing wedge politics.
Well, that's brilliant. But he's in the game playing wedge politics. But Mr. Mueller is still out there. So you've created this controversy. You stoked the flames of racism, but you're going to have another indictment come down pretty soon.
That's why we're trying to change the topic.
Very quickly, because we don't have David here all the time. I wanted to ask him real quickly, David, what happens if he pardons all of them and he, you know, Teresa just mouthed it's not going to happen. I'm mouthing it is going to happen because it's his only chance. It's his only way he sees himself as getting out of it. And so what happens if he fires Mueller?
So there were some things that happened a few months back that I thought was very, very interesting. One of those things being bringing in the Attorney General for the state of New York in on an investigation involving what I believe to be the investigation of Paul Manafort.
Sure.
Right? So the president's ability to pardon, while they're applicable to federal charges, they're not applicable to the state charges. So
you mentioned this a number of times here, and we think it was a very smart thing. But you're a state official. I mean, you're a district attorney. Are you telling me you think that Schneiderman has the same resources to pursue this that a federal prosecutor has?
I think Schneiderman, along with the resources that Mr. Mueller has available to him, could in fact do that job. I think if there is an open channel of communication and sharing, I think that the Attorney General for the state of New York is perfectly poised to do the work. In addition to the fact that one of the things that this attorney general can also do is have other attorney generals join the fray where jurisdiction is feasible.
Uh-huh. And this is a technical question. I don't know if I know the answer to, but they can. There's no reason that they cannot work with the special prosecutor's office, right? There's no legal
not
reason
now.
They can work
there's
together.
There's nothing barring the
there's no legal
not
reason.
Now. But what happens after they fire him?
The Attorney General still has, if in fact, and I mean, we're all speculating here because we're not inside the offices of the AG, but if the information and the evidence is being shared and they're working on this together, the termination of the special prosecutor isn't going to deter the Attorney General from moving forward with the information and the evidence that he has.
Your mouth to God's ear.
Paul Manafort is a very important target.
Sure.
Very, very important target. I believe that, first of all, if you're a special counsel, usually the U.S. attorney's offices, they don't usually proceed with cases unless they have proof beyond a reasonable doubt before they walk into a grand jury. So these are perhaps the most highly skilled, crafty strategists that have comprised this team. And I believe that the reveal the other day of the Papadopoulos plea, I thought that was very strategic, and it sends a very loud message. And I believe it's only a matter of time before we have more cooperating witnesses.
All right, we're going to end there. My thanks to everyone for being a part of the conversation. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, David Soares, Teresa Bourgeois, thank you all for your insights. Appreciate it. We welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation and continue with the roundtable right after this.